You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Hi, I'm Roseanne Cash. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate today, which is very exciting. Emotions like anxiety and fear can be overwhelming, but according to Joseph Ledoux, these emotional responses are part of an evolutionary development in the brain designed to keep us safe. As a professor at NYU's Center for Neuroscience and director of the Emotional Brain Institute, which is a joint venture between NYU and the Nathan Klein Institute, he's researching why even the smallest sight, sound, or smell can trigger a strong emotional response and what we can do about it. And when he's not in the lab, he acts as the lead singer and songwriter of a brainy band I've worked with, actually, called the Amygdaloids. His upcoming book, Anxious, will be published by Viking. And I'm pleased to welcome Joseph Ledoux to our show today. Hi, Joe.
Hi there.
How are you?
Good.
I should say that we're friends and that I contributed vocals to the Amygdaloids song, Mind Over Matter. So I knew you as a musician first, which is odd, isn't it?
That's funny, people who... I think you're the only one.
I meant, right? But you've worked on the brain for almost three decades. And your first degrees were in business, is that correct?
I had 2 degrees in business. And, you know, it was the late 60s. I didn't really care that much for it. It was Vietnam. And I thought, well, maybe I can go into the music industry. I'd always wanted to be involved in music. My first job was as a disc jockey in high school.
Is that right?
Yeah.
So it was very circuitous then to get to neuroscience. Why did you go from business, music, neuroscience?
So the one thing that sort of captured my interest in business was sort of consumer psychology, why people buy the stuff they buy and, you know, how can agencies protect them. I was interested in being a Nader's Raider. That was before Ralph Nader did some bad things later, but like with elections and so forth. Psychology interested me, so I started getting involved in psychology, and from there took a course with a guy who was studying the brain and said, this is for me, and I just jumped ship. And
where were you in school?
LSU.
Uh-huh. So neuroscience, you didn't just jump into it. It doesn't seem like something you can jump into. But so it was a slow development through psychology and
right.
Then into the actual physiology of the brain. Is that right?
Right, yes. So I started, my PhD was in something that was pretty light on the neuroscience end. I was studying patients that had a certain kind of surgery, split brain surgery.
What is split brain surgery?
It's a surgical procedure where the brain is basically split in half in an effort to stop seizures from jumping around in the brain.
And people survive the surgery?
They do. It's only done as a very, very last resort, but
wow.
Then it helps make drugs more effective. So all I had to do was kind of paper and pencil test and very simple kinds of things. So I didn't have to do a lot of technical things. But over a 12-year period after my PhD, I spent at a lab at Cornell Medical School where every neuroscientific technique available was there.
Mm.
And so I got to just sort of like do a lot of on-the-job training and go through an anatomical phase, a physiological phase, biochemical. I learned everything there.
But you're particularly interested in one specific emotion, fear. Why?
Well, I started out interested in emotion in the big sense of the word. And, you know, when you got to figure out how to study that. And so I looked for, and I decided at the time that I had to study it in animals because there were no techniques available for really studying the human brain.
But the animals' brains are the same, or they're different from human brains, right? Not really.
I mean,
good to know.
It's yes and no is the answer. If you want to study language, you shouldn't do that in a rat. But if you're interested in basic kind of emotional responses, the rat brain and the human brain are more or less the same.
Well, much of your research takes place in one very specific part of the brain called the amygdala.
That's right.
Okay, so where is it and what is it?
Okay, I'm going to shoot an arrow through your eye and another one through your ear.
Please don't do that.
And where they come together is your amygdala on that side of the brain. There's one on each side.
Which eye?
Either eye, both sides of the brain. So just a line going through here and a line going through here, and they'll come up right where,
so it's
behind your ears, basically.
At the center of the brain, then?
Not so, it's like towards the, I mean, there's a lot in between the amygdala and the
center. One hopes so. and so what is the amygdala responsible for?
Not as much as people say, I'm afraid. But it, you know, one of its main jobs is to detect threats and to orchestrate responses to threats. So when I study, when I say I'm studying emotion, turns out I'm not studying emotion in the sense that most people out there listening to us right now probably think of what emotion is.
Uh-huh.
And that's why I can study it in a rat, because what I'm looking at is the way the brain detects and responds to threats. And in a human, that occurs unconsciously, the same as it does in a rat. So it's a way of, you know, allowing evolution to do the hard work for you initially. So you're walking through the woods and you freeze, and then you notice there's a snake on the ground.
Mm.
Or you're stepping off Varick Street out here and the bus goes flying by, and then you notice the bus has been there and that your heart is beating. So the brain is able to respond to things like this automatically before you consciously know what to do. Mm-hmm. The feelings then come in later. But I'm not studying that. I'm studying the first part in the rat, how the brain detects and responds to threats.
Uh-huh. I'm Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Joseph Ledoux about the brain, the amygdala, and you've named your band the Amygdaloids. Now, does this have a special meaning, symbolic meaning?
I don't know. It sounded like kind of a punky kind of name. And
it does. I could imagine them opening for The Clash in the day.
So, we used to, my friend Tyler Volk and I were the kind of lead people starting this. We used to play at Christmas parties around NYU, and we gave ourselves various names, and one of Tyler's girlfriend at the time said we should call yourself the Amygdaloids or something. So, so yeah, that's great. So we'll do that.
I'm so curious about science and music and the connection in the brain. Does the amygdala play any part in the creative process?
You know, it's really hard to say. I mean, some people would say because it's involved in emotion, it probably contributes to music. But I think, you know, we have to ask what kind of emotional process is the amygdala involved in. I'm not sure it really is in that that general sense of emotion, the way people think of the word emotion. It's more specific in what I've been talking about. It might also contribute to positive kinds of responses as well. So you could say that there could be some, you know, either positive or negative response to music that the amygdala might contribute to. That's really BS because we haven't really studied it in much detail.
But does music soothe the savage breast in the amygdala? Is there any?
Yes. I think, you know, a lot of things like this, we have to just ask ourselves what we know from our own personal experience. Whether the amygdala does it or not, we know that music does these things. It, you know, has this amazing ability to get to the sweet spot of emotion and memory in our brain and do these things to us, right? Whether it's the amygdala or something else is kind of secondary to that, and we should look for where that is, but I wouldn't necessarily go to the amygdala as necessarily the hot spot.
Part of a creative process. But since you have this kind of profound understanding, cognitive understanding of fear and anxiety in the brain, does your cognitive understanding help mitigate your own anxiety ever?
In a sense, how does it help? Well, if I start to feel something, I can say, well, that is because my amygdala probably detected something. It's causing my autonomic nervous system to kind of rev up a little bit. And I know that if the sympathetic part of my autonomic nervous system, which is the fight-flight part, is being a little active, if I engage the parasympathetic part by taking a deep breath, that's going to slow it down. So everybody knows they should take a deep breath when they feel anxious, but that's why, because it counteracts the sympathetic nervous system when you do that.
You know, that's so interesting, because I knew a singer, and she was talking about stage fright, and she said the only difference between fear and excitement is breathing.
Uh-huh.
So what you're saying, there could be a scientific foundation for that.
There absolutely is, yes.
That's so fascinating. I want to talk about your music for a minute. Your latest album, All in Our Minds, all the songs have something in common. They all have the word mind in the title. So this is a concept record.
It is. Yeah. All our records are concept records.
Is that right? And all of your bandmates are scientists.
Well, that was originally true. I guess we could sort of say that. So the other, besides Tyler Volk, there's Daniela Schiller, who's now a professor of neuroscience at Mount Sinai Medical School, and Amanda Thorpe. Now, Amanda is a professional musician who graces us with her presence and has a wonderful voice. So she does great copies of the parts you've done, for example, of course. And she has a degree in neuropsychology from University College in London. So we count her as a kind of...
Oh, I would count that, yeah, definitely. Right. And now you've written several books. Have you thought about writing a book about music, like Oliver Sacks or Dan Levitin?
That's really not my thing. I like music and I love it, but I haven't kind of integrated it into my professional life except using... I've gone the other way. I've taken scientific concepts, things about mind and brain, and put them into songs, but I haven't gone in the other way and used music as a kind of topic of research.
But maybe it happens without you knowing it. You know, it may affect the famous amygdala. Yeah. But tell me about this new technique you're using in the lab called optogenetics.
Yeah, that's an amazing new thing. This was something created, invented, I'm not sure exactly how you would say it, but by this guy called Isaroff in California. And what it does is it allows you to put a molecule that is able to cause neurons to fire action potentials. That's what neurons do when they're active. They fire these action potentials. So you take this molecule and you attach a light-sensitive molecule to it, right? And so you have these. They have this basically this complex that is sensitive to light. And you put it into the brain, into the amygdala. And then you can shine a little tiny fiber optic cable. You have to lower it into the amygdala. You do this in animals, not
people.
That
sounds painful.
No, it's under anesthesia. The brain feels no pain. So you put that
I
in.
I would disagree, but go ahead.
you turn on the light, and that part of the amygdala starts being active. So what we're able to do with that is to create learning without any external experience. So we give the rat a sound. Normally, we'd give the rat a sound and pair it with a shock, and so he'd become afraid of the sound. But we can skip the shock. All we have to do is give him the sound and turn on the light in the amygdala, and that's enough to create the fear of the light. And that shows that the importance of this part of the amygdala in that learning process of associating threats with neutral stimuli with threatening stimuli, and then forming a memory that then becomes a way of triggering behavior later.
Well, then it seems you could do that in the reverse, in a way, and unstore
a
fearful memory.
You should be a scientist.
Well,
that's a great experiment.
I play one on TV, but go ahead. How do you? You did tell me something. We had lunch once, and you spoke about recovery from post-traumatic stress.
Right.
About restoring memories right. In a different way, and that's how people could recover.
Can you talk about that? Yeah, so again, all of this is pioneered in rats, and then it's starting to be applied to people. But the jury's still out on the human memory aspect because human memory is so complex.
Yes.
But there's some positive evidence. But the basic phenomenon is if you take a stimulus that is troubling in some way, say a traumatic stimulus, and you give it to the rat, it's a fearful rather than trauma for him, but it's just minor. So you give him the tone that's been paired with the shock. And then after this is just giving the tone alone, but after he hears the tone, if he's given a drug that interferes with the restorage of the memory, and that's too complicated to explain, but you give a drug that interferes with the restorage of the memory, and then he hears the sound later, he no longer acts afraid in the presence of that sound, no longer freezes.
Is this a beta blocker drug? A
beta blocker will do it, it's the basic kind of drug that you want to use is a protein synthesis inhibitor. You can't use that in people, but beta blockers in the brain will modulate the protein synthesis process. So you can use a beta blocker to kind of tone down the protein synthesis process.
Now, do you do this with therapy or exercise or religious faith or anything? Or is this just purely this, just the restoring of the memory?
Yeah, in the animal experiments, we just do it in the simplest possible way. Give the tone, block the storage, start over again, test, and there's no fear. So, this is the eternal sunshine of the spotless mind phenomenon.
Wow.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. Okay, I need to wrap up, but you're currently writing a book about anxiety. And when does that come out, Joe?
I have to write it first. I think probably a year and a half.
A year and a half? I'm going to be running out and buying that book instantly. I'm speaking with Joseph Ledoux, author of the book The Emotional Brain, The Mysterious Underpinnings of Emotional Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Later on in the show, we'll move from the inner workings of your brains to the inner workings of the universe when Lisa Randall stops by to explain the search for the elusive Higgs boson. I'm Roseanne Cash, in today for Leonard Lopate. This is WNYC and WNYC.org, and we'll have more with Joseph Ledoux after a break.
In my mind's eye, we had love, it was good.
Oh yeah.
Mind over matter, something I'm trying to do.
I'm Roseanne Cash, here for Leonard Lopate, and I'm speaking with Joseph Ledoux. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. Joe, your website says a fundamental assumption in your work on fear and anxiety in the brain is that the brain has multiple memory systems, each devoted to different kinds of memory functions. Is the combined system of the amygdala, which we were speaking about before, and the hippocampus the only part of the brain that creates emotion based on memory? Are those two things together?
Probably not. I mean, if you think about it, it's almost wrong to say that the brain has memory systems, because I think every aspect of the brain can store memory in some way. Memory is basically synaptic plasticity, which means synapses are, of course, the connections between neurons, and plasticity is their ability to change what they do, those connections. And so when we form a memory, connections are being changed and storing a new connection, basically.
So is every time you recall a memory, does it get restored in the same way, or can you restore it differently?
I think every time you recall it, you store it differently. And what that means is that this is part of this reconsolidation process that we were talking about in the therapeutic sense, where you could eliminate unwanted memories. And the reason you can do that is because every time you have a memory and take it out, you have to restore it and put it back in. That's how all of this research got discovered. And in some sense, your memory is only as good as your last memory.
That's so interesting. What does that mean?
Well, a person who witnesses a crime and goes to court to testify and talks about what they read in the newspaper rather than about the police report that they gave at the time is experiencing that, because the reading of the story updated the memory. It retrieved the memory, and then it got updated, including some of that other stuff as part of the memory. So, memory usually works pretty well for us, but it always has the opportunity for messing up.
Well, okay, this may be in the realm of metaphysics, but if you recall a memory and you change some of the details in that memory and restore it that way, and maybe you do it several times to, really sink it in, does it change you? Does it change the sense of trauma or anxiety, or can you change a sad memory to a joyful memory?
It's probably hard to do intentionally, because you, by simply thinking about it and knowing about it, you sort of protect yourself against it. But there are war heroes that go around to 100 cities on tour telling their hero story. And the story on City 100 has nothing to do with the one at the first city, because it's gotten better and better every time.
I know that, not just hero stories, but in a lot of other stories. But aren't emotions associated with physical responses, like fear, heightened blood pressure and sweating?
Right, some are.
And so if you change the physical responses, can you change the sense of fear?
So beta blockers are sometimes used by musicians or other performers for stage fright. And what they do is they slow down the body's physiological response. So you don't feel that, your heart racing and all of that stuff that then kind of makes you cognitively anxious on the inside. So if you can reduce that by breathing or with drugs or whatever, you're going to feel a little better. And, if you feel a little better, then that gives you more confidence to move forward.
But does that slow down your responses, and does it change the playing as well?
Right. So sometimes it's been proposed that rescue workers should be treated with beta blockers before they go in, so that they would be less anxious, but also because of the role of beta blockers in the restorage, blocking the restorage of the memory that we talked about before. So those are two different roles. One is in the body and the other is in the brain. So some beta blockers only work in the body and some go to the brain.
I see.
So you could give a beta blocker that goes to the brain, and then maybe the rescue worker would no longer remember the trauma that they went through in pulling people out of planes and so forth. So one question is that a good idea to remove trauma from the brain? But another is, would they be affected? Would their performance be altered? And I think the jury's out on those issues.
I'd never thought about that, that paramedics, they live with daily trauma and that, you know, they might be served by something like that almost more than any other group.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between anxiety and fear and the way it's processed in the brain?
Well, certainly there's a traditional definition that distinguishes them. So fear is the an emotion that is concerned with some immediately present threat, and anxiety is more about a threat that hasn't happened yet. At least by the classic definitions.
But people can develop anxiety disorders over time. You don't have to be born with an anxiety.
Oh, right. That's
right.
For sure.
And when does this evolutionary development, you know, that makes fear helpful to us and keeps us safe, when does it go from helpful to harmful? Is there a dividing point?
That's a subject of debate as to, some people say that anxiety disorders are not disorders. Everybody has anxiety. And so we should be careful about what we use the term disorder for, especially if it's a natural function of the brain. But to me, a person has a problem if they are not dealing with their personal life on a daily basis in the most effective way. So they should, whether you call that a disorder or not, they might need help and treatment to get through the day in a way that otherwise they'd be impaired.
You also say that problems with fear and anxiety are co-conditions with many other psychiatric disorders like depression, schizophrenia, autism, as well as in most major medical problems. But
right.
People who have anxiety related to medical problems, is that a chicken and egg situation?
Of course, yeah. So it could be. It could go both ways. But certainly someone who has, is just diagnosed with cancer or something like that is going to worry about it. Now, as soon as you start to worry, you're having a stress response. Stress alters your immune system. You're going to be getting colds and other things, and so everything gets more complicated by stress and fear and anxiety and all of these things.
And do you anticipate you're going to find a better way to treat them through some of these techniques you spoke about?
These techniques from animal research by my lab and other labs is they're coming into the mainstream and being applied. Things are being developed. For example, the use of D-cycloserine was discovered as a treatment for anxiety disorders was discovered by Michael Davis and his colleague, Kerry Ressler and others at Emory through their animal research. And now it's become a way to enhance cognitive behavioral therapy. So, and things we've discovered about altering memory and so forth. So these things are coming out of animal work and entering into the treatment domain of people.
It brings up a really interesting topic about ethics, the ethics of erasing memory or even reducing trauma, to alter someone's experience.
Right.
I mean, obviously, if they're debilitated by fear, anxiety, and trauma, that's
right.
Something else. But talk a little bit about the ethics of this.
So when we first published this work, and it was written about in the New York Times, a trauma therapist wrote in to say that, maybe this is a bad idea. Let's say a person's lived with the memories of the Holocaust for 50 years or something, and now you start erasing those memories, what happens to their personality? Well, the good news is that what we seem to be altering more is the emotional response rather than the cognitive memory in those situations. So we talked about two kinds of memories, a kind of unconscious memory that one can have, but also a conscious memory. These are separately stored in the brain, one by the hippocampus for the conscious memory. The amygdala is doing the unconscious automatic response, and that's what we tend to be affecting when we block the restorage of these emotional responses.
So the hippocampus is to do with cognitive memory and the amygdala with unconscious memory?
Right.
Is that what that...
Right.
Okay. Diana left a comment on our show page asking, what is going on in my brain when I am heartbroken or feeling a deep sorrow? This is not just being sad. I mean, when you feel a very deep, deep hole near your stomach, what's playing havoc with her brain? That's what she's asking.
Well, she's, you know, a lot of these sort of folk ideas about, you know, what about our emotions, like heartbroken and so forth, come because we have these sensations from our body. And these enter into our brain because we have ways that our body and brain are connected. So our brain can sense what's going on in the body just as it can sense what's going on in the outside world. So the combination of things that you feel when you're heartbroken, I'm just guessing, I don't work on this, so I'm just kind of wildly speculating, but there's probably some pattern of physiological and muscular responses that are sensed by the brain and entering into the brain's awareness that contributes to what you feel, when you're adding into the fact that you have these cognitive representations of being heartbroken or being sad about the loss of someone. So it all kind of gets mushed together and the brain is aroused and there are lots of things going on, but I imagine there's some bodily feedback that's contributing to that.
Can you change this? I mean, can you pull yourself up by the bootstraps? Does that kind of thing work? Talking to yourself?
I think
affirmations.
Everyone is different, right? And so some people that might work very well for, and others are going to need some more external help.
Now, you talked about timing in treatment, there being a kind of a window of opportunity mm-hmm. to change a memory.
Right.
What does that mean?
Okay, that's a little complicated, but let's see if we can find the short version of the
dumb it down for me, Joe.
After you've retrieved a memory, you've got a window in which to alter it again, because what's happening in this reconsolidation process is that chemical mechanisms are triggered in the brain, and they last for about 3 or 4 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So you have that 3 or 4 hour window in which to change a memory after it's been retrieved.
That's it, 3 or 4 hours.
Right. Well, then you can retrieve it again and start over. But that process takes some time to start. So if you start the process and don't wait a certain period of like a minute or so, then you've not benefited from this ability to update the memory. So let's say you're doing exposure therapy, which you give one stimulus, you give another, you give another, you give another. If you do that all in a row, it doesn't happen quite as effectively as if you do one and then wait for 10 minutes, 20 minutes, something like that, and then start the others, because you need the first one to trigger the process biochemically, and you need 20 minutes, 10 minutes, or 20 minutes for that process to really kind of rev up properly.
That sounds very specific.
Well,
the timing.
It is. And we've done this in rats and in people, and the timing is about the same, at least about 10 minutes, and then you've got about 3 hours.
But who is self-aware enough to get themselves to you after they've been traumatized?
As we work all this out, this hasn't been tried in therapy yet, so we don't, human memory is really complicated, so whether the 10-minute window is going to work for a real trauma,
I see.
We don't know. This has been done in experimental studies by Liz Phelps and Daniela Schiller at NYU, where they've given the people, a picture paired with a shock, and they can do the same things we can do with a rat where it gets a tone paired with a shock, but whether this is going to work in, a clinical setting. But if it does play out and it becomes effective, then the person would go to a therapist to do this kind of procedure with, and the therapist would have to know about the timing. But if it becomes effective, it'd be built into the system.
Mm. These processes, can you see them when you're in the lab? Can you see on an MRI synapse going towards the amygdala? You can't.
An MRI is like, a golf ball in the brain, basically.
Right.
We're talking about things that are so small that are key. That's why the animal research is so important, because we're able to deal with these very, very tiny synaptic events and molecular events. But in the human brain, with imaging, you're dealing with, big, big areas, like a millimeter, whereas we're 100 or 1,000 times smaller.
Well, in addition to working on your upcoming book, Anxious, which, as I said, I'll be running right out to buy, you're also collaborating on a new multimedia show. What is that about?
Well, my friend and a musician, a real wonderful musician, Ward White, and I are trying to put together a thing that'll be, this is Ward's idea, but it's going to be part biography, part science lecture, and all tied together with music that Ward is going to orchestrate. And this is all about my longtime fascination with music ever since I was a kid, and on into today, and we're going to try to tie use the importance of music as a kind of memory trigger to recollect events, to tie it all again into my science, but also into my life.
That's interesting, because a caller just wrote in about retrieving memories that a person might have blocked out after trauma, the reverse of what you're talking about. Can you just speak a little about that?
So, yeah, let's talk about repression. I don't know how much time we have to talk about repression.
Not long enough, I'll tell you that much.
some of what is possibly called repression is due to the role of stress hormones in blocking memory storage. So memories might be partially encoded in a way that's hard to retrieve in a traumatic situation because of the intense release of stress hormones. So whether one has intentionally blocked it out because it's so anxiety-provoking or because it just simply didn't get encoded during the learning experience, you have a memory that is hard to get at. So the problem is as you start to retrieve that hard-to-get-at memory, you may be getting bits and pieces that you then reconsolidate now, and that becomes the memory. So you think you've retrieved the real memory, but maybe you're just recreating a false memory by retrieving these things in partial form. Not necessarily, but maybe.
Well, Joe, what is next? Are you writing songs still?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Every day.
Really? Every day? That's better than me.
I do something. I try every day. It doesn't always come out.
And you're planning on another record?
Yes, definitely.
That's fantastic. Well, I'm Roseanne Cash. I'm sitting in for Leonard Lopate, and I've been speaking to Joseph Ledoux, who wrote the book The Emotional Brain, The Mysterious Underpinnings of Emotional Life. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Joe is also the singer and songwriter of The Amygdaloids, a rock band that makes music about the mind and brain. Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for playing the music.
Oh, yeah. Coming up next, writer and musician Mike Doty discusses his memoir, The Book of Drugs, and his latest albums. I'm Roseanne Cash, and today for Leonard Lopate, this is WNYC and WNYC.com.
And I sure don't know where to stop. If I tell you everything, if I open up my soul.